It is a pleasure to be back. It's been some time since I've seen your cherubic faces. Been gone for about 6 weeks and out and about, traveling to and fro on the face of the earth, trying to stay out of mischief. It's a little known fact, but according to Benjamin Franklin, the inability of the colonists to get power to issue their own money permanently out of the hands of George III of England and the international bankers was the prime reason for the Revolutionary War. Having obtained such independence, the colonies carved out from their individual sovereignties a new federal government, the United States of America. The history of this nation from the Revolutionary War of 1776 until 1913 was in large part the story of an epic struggle to remain free of monetary control by the European central banks. That struggle was finally lost in 1913 when then President Woodrow Wilson signed into the law the Federal Reserve Act and thus reintroduced the international banking cartel into American monetary life and policy. Sounds implausible, doesn't it? So let's let Mr. Wilson speak for himself. I am a most unhappy man. I have unwittingly ruined my country. A great industrial nation is controlled by its system of credit. Our system of credit is concentrated. The growth of the nation and all of our activities are now in the hands of a few men. We have come to be one of the worst ruled, one of the most completely controlled and dominated governments in the civilized world. No longer a government by free opinion, no longer a government by conviction and the vote of the majority, but a government by the opinion and duress of a small group of dominant men. How could then President Woodrow Wilson make such a claim? After all, the United States was still in its ascendancy. It hadn't even reached its peak. It was because he knew when he signed the Federal Reserve Act into law that he was creating a body of people, a body of governors that functioned outside of the U.S. government and more as part of a global banking cartel than anything else. Indeed, the world's bankers do not take their direction from their national or supranational governments, nor are they required to answer to them. The most poignant example of that fact, and one which largely went unnoticed and largely went uncommented on by the press, occurred in November of 2007. In an article entitled "Central Bankers Riding to the Rescue," which appeared in the December Times, a British publication, center-right, not a radical conspiracy theorist type of publication at all. It was reported that, and I'm quoting, a series of secret calls took place between the world's leading central banks. Ben Bernanke, chairman of America's Federal Reserve, and King at the Bank of England were said to be instrumental in driving the action plan forward. Their market specialists then worked out the details. This joint operation by the Federal Reserve and the U.S. in the U.S. and the Bank of England, the European Central Bank, the Swiss National Bank, and the Bank of Canada was both an admission by these men that the global monetary system had been mortally wounded and that they needed to do something to, as they put it, address elevated pressures in short-term funding markets. In other words, we're out of money. The world is out of money. Those meetings then led to a joint announcement from the world's central banks. The announcement was an announcement about their intention to infuse close to $1 trillion into the system, which they did almost immediately following that announcement. Had they not, capital markets all over the world would have collapsed in 2007. The Times characterized this action as, and I'm quoting again, the equivalent of the central bank cavalry arriving to head off a massacre in the money markets. More important than the action taken is the fact that not one banker in that cartel asked for permission to act from their respective president, prime minister, or legislative body. Government leaders in the U.S., the EU, Switzerland, and Canada did nothing to initiate this action that anyone knows about. Nor do they possess the power, did they possess the power, to enjoin the bankers from acting. This action was, without question, one of the most profound global acts undertaken since the British Commonwealth controlled financial markets at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century. Yet even the opponents of globalization and the conspiracy theorists seemed oblivious to the significance of this world's monetary markets on the verge of total collapse, the impotence of national and supranational governments to alter that course, and the power that resides in the hands of a very few people in the world to avert what most people would rightly call an unmitigated disaster. These people are called central bankers. This begs the question, of course, as to who's really in charge. Mayor Anselm Rothschild, arguably one of the world's most notable bankers, doesn't seem confused about the answer to that question. He said, "Permit me to issue and control the money of a nation, and I care not who makes its laws." Past United States President James A. Garfield, one of our two presidents who was assassinated, agreed with Mr. Rothschild. President Garfield once noted, "Whoever controls the volume of money in our country is absolute master of all industry and commerce. And when you realize that the entire system is very easily controlled one way or another by a few powerful men at the top, you will not have to be told how periods of inflation and depression originate." Two great mysteries overshadow life: love and money. I know nothing about either, so we're through. Seriously, plenty gets said about love. I don't know whether any of that's true. But not so much about money. At least not so much that's truly important about money. The anomaly to that is that the monetary system to which we are subject affects every important aspect of our lives. It determines what we buy or sell, whether we buy or sell it, and what we pay for it when we do. It shapes our prosperity or poverty. It defines the degree to which we can claim to be free to choose our destiny, individually and nationally. Solomon said in Ecclesiastes 10 and verse 19, "Money is the answer for everything." And in that context, Solomon is illustrating the fact that money is both a force in the corruption of leaders and their answer to escape their own depravity. That is to say, money is seen as both the source and expression of their power over all that they rule. And there is certainly no greater truth when it comes to money than that. Yet if the question is asked, from where does money come? The response is likely to be similar to the answer to the question, where do babies come from? No, money doesn't come from a hospital. Okay, never mind. Neither do babies, by the way. Money doesn't come from printing presses either. It doesn't come from national mints. Most people believe that money is created by governments. And while that is true, it is only true to a point. The bills and coins that you and I exchange daily for goods and services are merely symbols of money. Money that's created in mints, money that's authorized by sovereign governments. But the vast majority of money is not created by government mints. It is created every day in huge amounts by private corporations known as banks. We're taught to believe that banks lend out money that has been entrusted to them by depositors. That's a nice image. It's easy for us to picture. It's a shame it's just not true. The truth is that banks create the money they loan. They don't create it from bank earnings or monies on deposit, but they create it directly from the borrower's promise to repay the amount borrowed plus interest. So when you get a loan to buy a house or a car or to start a business, or you sign that application for a credit card which you receive in the mail, money is created. In other terms, your signature on a loan document is your promise to repay the money that the bank is going to create for you. You didn't know you had that kind of power, did you? That signature means that a bank can now bring into existence money. The amount of the loan. The bank writes that money into your account. The debt created by your signature then becomes the bank's money to lend. Your debt, their asset. You must be kidding, Mr. Andrews. Well, no, actually I'm not. But in order for us to understand exactly how we got to this place, let's go back to the beginning. Speaking of tales, Aesop's fables, let's talk about the goldsmith's tale. Once upon a time, and in whatever land you care to name, just about anything was used for money. The only requirement was that it had to be portable. People had to be able to carry it from place to place, and they had to have faith that it could be later traded for things that they valued, things like food and clothing and livestock. You get the idea. You're familiar with the concept. You need to eat. You need to clothe yourself. You need to house yourself. Gold and silver were attractive, not just because they were pretty to look at, but because they were soft and easy to work with. And some cultures became expert with these metals and used them as a medium of exchange, used them for money. Goldsmiths made trade easier by casting these metals into coins, standardized weights and measures whose purity had been certified. To protect his gold, the goldsmith needed a vault. It wasn't long before the townsfolk, who themselves had gold and silver, which was obviously precious, and no place to put it to protect it, began to go to the goldsmith, knocking on his door, wanting to rent space in his vault to store their money. Before you knew it, the goldsmith had rented every last inch of shelf space in his vault and was earning a handsome rental income from doing so. As time went on, the goldsmith noticed that his renters, now depositors, rarely came in to get their gold, and never did they all come at once. Why? Well, because the goldsmith would issue receipts for gold on deposit. And the claim checks, those receipts or claim checks that the goldsmith had written for the gold, were being traded in the marketplace in lieu of the actual gold. Much easier to carry. Convenient to write out amounts owed or amounts paid. The paper money was just far more convenient. You're familiar with the concept. You have a checkbook. You write a check. You have a debit card. You have a credit card. It's a similar concept. And amounts paid could be written instead of laboriously being counted out in coins and then having change to be made. And so it was the precursor to what we do today when we write a check or we present our debit card or our credit card for payment for goods or services. Meanwhile, the enterprising goldsmith always thinking about another way to make money, started another business. He began lending out his gold and charging interest on it. So if you needed more money than you had on deposit at the goldsmith's vault, now almost a bank, you could borrow the goldsmith's gold and you would be charged a certain amount of interest. Now, the claim checks that were so convenient and already being traded were well accepted, so when the borrower took out a loan, instead of taking the money in gold, he asked for a claim check. As commerce and industry expanded, more people went to the goldsmith for loans. This got the enterprising goldsmith to thinking again. He knew that very few of his depositors ever removed their gold. Well, wait a minute, this looks good. So he said to himself, "Self, I bet that in addition to issuing claim checks for loans against your gold, against my gold, I could also issue claim checks for loans against depositors' gold. As long as the loans were repaid, the depositors would be none the wiser and no one would be worse off." Clever fellow. The goldsmith had now morphed into a banker. You might think of him more as a thief, given the scenario just presented to you. As such, he would make a far greater profit than he was making simply loaning against his own gold, which he did. For years and without depositors' knowledge, the goldsmith, now turned banker, enjoyed a good income from the interest earned on everybody else's assets. The prominent lender grew steadily wealthier, much wealthier than his fellow citizens. And so while he made a secret of the means by which he had earned his wealth, he was not discreet about the fact of his wealth. In fact, as people are wont to be and want to do, he flaunted it. What good is wealth, after all, if you can't show it off to your friends and neighbors? Chins began to wag, however, and suspicion grew that the goldsmith was spending the depositors' money. The depositors agreed to confront the goldsmith and threatened to withdraw their gold if he did not disclose to them the source of his unbelievable wealth. Remember, though, that the goldsmith was not actually lending the gold to borrowers. He was merely issuing paper, which theoretically could be exchanged for gold in his vault. So when the depositors were permitted to inspect the goldsmith's vault, what they saw was their gold. Well, now this is strange, isn't it? Nonetheless, the goldsmith's scheme had been exposed. And rather than be drawn and quartered, tarred and feathered, run out of town on a rail, be forced to take a long walk off a short plank, you get the idea. And the depositors, rather than withdraw their gold, exploited an opportunity and demanded that the goldsmith, now their banker, cut them in on the profits by paying them a share of the interest that he was earning. Everybody wins, a big win-win. And that was the beginning of banking. Sounds pretty sleazy, doesn't it? The bank paid a low interest rate on deposits of other people's money, and then he loaned out at a higher interest rate to commercial borrowers and others. The difference provided a profit to the bank and covered its cost of operation. The system was simple, and it satisfied the need for credit. And that's a nice story, once upon a time. But it is once upon a time, because that's not the way banking's done today. See, the banker had lost a pretty substantial percentage of his profit. There is a law, an unwritten law in human existence called the law of convenience. The law of convenience says that once somebody has been given something, enjoyed the benefits of it, it's really inconvenient to take it away from them. And so the banker was not content with his reduced income. The share remaining after he'd shared the interest with his depositors. And, of course, the demand for credit as Europeans set out to colonize the world was growing. Now, remember that under the system that the banker had created, loans were limited by the amount of the gold that depositors had in the banker's vault. So, in other words, he was not making loans on money or gold that he didn't have. And that's when the banker got a great idea. Since no one but himself knew what was in his vault, he could lend out claim checks on gold that wasn't even there. Now, lest you think that this only happened back then, I would encourage you to consider what happens now with respect to oil futures. Why are you paying $4 a gallon for gas or more? Because people buy oil they don't own, hold it until it's produced, and then turn around and sell it. Or then you have the Enron Corporation, who sold plenty of energy that they didn't even own, that hadn't even been created. There's nothing new under the sun. So this banker's bold idea was, no one's going to know. I can write claim checks on gold I don't even have. So long as all the claim holders did not present themselves at the same time, demanding real gold in exchange for their claim checks, how would anyone ever find out? And in the banker's experience, that kind of phenomenon just didn't occur. The idea that the banker would just create money out of nothing was just too outrageous to believe. It's outrageous for us to believe today that things like this happen. And so for a long time, the thought did not occur to people that something like this could happen. But as you might suspect, the power to create money out of nothing went to the banker's head. And there is another law among humans. It's a very simple law. Pigs get fat, hogs get slaughtered. This banker is about to get slaughtered because his ostentatious loans and conspicuous consumption once again triggered suspicion among his depositors. Rumors spread, and wealthy depositors showed up demanding their gold. The end game was about to be played. Soon a sea of claim check holders flooded the streets outside the bank, which was now closed. Everyone's worst fears had become a reality. This goldsmith turned banker did not have sufficient gold to redeem their paper. This is called a run on the bank. You might remember a similar phenomenon recently with a bank known as Indy Bank, Indy Mac Bank, or whatever it is. You might remember that. People standing in lines trying to get their money. This is not an ancient phenomenon, but it is every banker's worst nightmare. This phenomenon of a run on the bank predictably ruined individual banks, and it destroyed confidence in all bankers. You think? The obvious solution, you say, is very simple. Outlaw the practice of creating money from nothing. Novel idea. Not acceptable. The problem with that solution is that the large volume of credit that had been extended by the bankers had become essential to the success of European economic expansion. Debt had created prosperity. Dangerous phenomenon. Debt had created prosperity. If banks did not extend credit, there would be a recession in the current economic activity and future economic growth. Worse, there could be a full-blown depression. So rather than outlaw the practice of creating money out of nothing, the solution, not surprisingly, clever people that bankers are, was to legalize the practice and regulate it. Bankers agreed to abide by limits to the amount of fictional loan money that they could create. The limit would still be an amount much larger than the actual gold or silver in their vault, but there would be a limit. Now, quite often, the ratio that is of fictional dollars to real dollars, or fictional money to real money, is set at about 9 to 1. Seems pretty high. And these regulations were enforced by surprise inspections. It was also arranged that in the event of a run, central banks would be created to help out smaller individual local banks to support them with emergency infusions of gold. And only if there were runs on a number of banks simultaneously would the credit bubble burst and the system come crashing down. You have to love diversification. Over the years, this, what is now known as the fractional reserve system, and its integrated networks of smaller banks tied to a central bank, has become this world's dominant money system. The system used to create money, the system used to extend credit, the system that this world functions on with respect to the creation of wealth. At the same time, the fraction of gold backing the debt money in our world today has shrunk. That is to say that the amount of actual assets backing the money that's in play in the economy in any given nation is virtually nothing. You might remember when President Nixon took the United States off the gold standard. And so today, and that's what that was about, by the way, today the basic nature of money has changed. In the past, money represented value. In the United States, for example, a dollar was actually a receipt which could be tendered and redeemed for gold. Likewise, the British pound could be exchanged for sterling silver. You can't do that today. Today, a dollar is a Federal Reserve note. If you pull one out and you look at it and read it, that's what you'll see. It's a Federal Reserve note. It's a paper or digital dollar, which can only be redeemed for another paper or digital dollar. In the past, privately created bank credit existed only in the form of private bank notes, which one could refuse, just the way that anyone can refuse your personal check. Your personal check is a private note, which anyone is free to accept or reject. Banks were in the same posture. That's not true today. In the present, privately created bank currency is legally convertible to what is called government-issued fiat currency. That is, sovereign governments have absolute sovereignty to, by their own fiat, create currency and give credit credence to and power to the money that is issued. And the institutions that they look to create that money are banks. Legal tender laws hold that citizens must accept this money as payment for debts. If you borrow money from me, and then you come to repay me in U.S. currency, and I reject payment in U.S. currency and demand payment in some other fashion, and then I take you to court to sue you to get you to pay me in the way that I want to be paid, the courts have the authority to tell me you're out of luck. You were offered legal currency, legal tender in the United States. You refused it. You're out of court. And you're out of luck. And by the way, you're out of money. So now the question is, if banks and governments can both create money, how much money exists? In the past, the total amount of money in existence was limited to the actual physical quantities of whatever physical commodity, gold or silver, or whatever other commodity, was in use as money. For example, in order for new gold or silver to be created, more gold or silver had to be found and dug out of the ground. That's the only way you could increase the money supply. But in the present, money is literally created as debt. That is, new money is created when anyone takes out a loan from the bank. A mortgage, credit card, a new business venture, home equity loan, auto, credit card for your dog. As a result, the total amount of money that can be created has only one real limit. That limit is what we're willing to tolerate in terms of debt. The modern money as debt system was given birth a little more than 300 years ago in jolly old England, when the first Bank of England was established by a royal charter to lend gold receipts at a modest fractional ratio of 2 to 1. That is, they could create $2 of debt for every, or 2 pounds of debt for every pound of gold. This was the thin entering wedge into the system that we now live under. The system is now worldwide, and it creates virtually unlimited amounts of money out of thin air. And as we will see, has virtually everyone on the planet chained to a perpetually growing debt that can never be repaid. Governments today place an additional statutory limit on the creation of new money by enforcing rules known as fractional reserve requirements. That's a joke, because banks operate outside, in many ways, government purview. These fractional reserve requirements are, in fact, arbitrary. They vary from country to country and from time to time. In the past, in the U.S., it was common to require banks to have at least $1 of real gold in the vault for every $10 of debt created. That no longer is true. Today, reserve requirement ratios no longer apply to the ratio of new money to gold. That is, these fractional reserve requirements used to apply number of dollars, actual gold or actual assets, to a certain percentage of debt. Now, clever bankers, bank reserves consist of two things: the amount of government. But now, the ratio of new debt money is compared to existing debt money. And as long as the ratio of new debt money to existing debt money is at acceptable limits, the bank can issue more debt. When banks issue debt, remember, they're creating assets for themselves. Today, a bank's reserve consists of two things: the amount of government-issued cash or other equivalents that has been deposited with a central bank, plus the amount of already existing debt money that the banks have created. Now, I'm not going to bore you with the math. You're welcome. But suffice it to say that in a system that requires a bank to have one actual dollar of cash, and this is a hypothetical, one actual dollar of cash for every $9 of credit it issues, it can, on an investment of $1,000, which it would place with a central bank, create approximately $100,000 in new money, all through debt. That works out to, when you do the math, please don't try to second guess me on this, that works out to about $90 of new money created from debt for every $1 of actual assets on deposit. All of it created from absolutely nothing. And yes, it's perfectly legal. This is important to the bank, because the bank is now collecting interest not on $1,000 of real money, but on $100,000, most of which is not real. Under this ingenious system, the books of each individual bank within a central banking system must also show that the bank has 10% more on deposit than it does out on loan. So if a bank has $100,000 of money out on loan, it's got to show that it has an additional $10,000 from other depositors before it can make any new loans and thus create more money. This gives the bank a real incentive to look for depositors which supports the general but very misleading notion that loans are made from deposits held at the bank. It's a massive deception, but it's one most people give very little thought to. Don't be confused. Banks do not seek depositors so that they can loan the money that the depositors leave with them. They seek depositors so that they can create new money at the rate of about $90 for every dollar deposited by creating more debt. This is good business if you can get it. On the off chance that the whole thing sounds ridiculous to you, consider this. In recent decades, as a result of lobbying by banks, requirements to make reserve deposits have all but disappeared. Not in this country, but certainly in Europe. And actual reserve ratios can be a lot higher than 9-1. And banks who are really clever for some types of accounts can get reserve ratios of 20-1 or 30-1. Imagine if you walked through the math, the amount of money we're talking about. It becomes millions and billions of dollars, depending on the amounts deposited. And what banks have done even more recently, by using loan fees to raise the required reserve from the borrower, banks have found a way to circumvent any governmental oversight on their lending practices whatsoever, because all of the money is handled privately and the reserve requirements are handled through private banking. The rules are complex, but the common sense reality isn't. The common sense reality is quite simple. Banks can create as much money as people can borrow. Let that sink in. About 95% of all money in existence today was created because someone signed a bank pledge of indebtedness. This can only happen with the assistance of government. Our governments are conspirators in this, or collaborators, depending on your particular view of the world. They are because, first of all, governments pass legal tender laws requiring the use of currency they authorize. National fiat currency, remember? Second, governments allow private bank credit to be paid out in this national fiat currency. That is, banks create the money, and the governments allow that money to be traded in the marketplace in terms of dollars or euros or pounds or whatever it is in vogue in whatever nation you're in. Third, government courts enforce debts. They actually are the bulldog for the banks. And finally, governments issue regulations to protect the money system's functionality and credibility with the public, which usually means keeping the public in the dark about what's really going on when there's a problem. In the fictional world of money that exists today, the only thing of value is your pledge as a borrower to repay it. That's the only thing of value. Another basic truth that's very simple. Without the document that you as a borrower or I as a borrower signed, the banker would have nothing to lend. Have you ever wondered how it is that governments, businesses, small and large, and even our families, your family and mine, can incur debt at the level that we do, sometimes astronomical? Have you ever wondered how there can be that much money out there to lend? Well, now you know the truth. There isn't. Isn't it astounding that despite all the wealth, innovation, technology, and seeming prosperity that surrounds us, most people are heavily in debt to bankers, banks, financial institutions? Has it ever troubled you that all of the people who actually produce all the real wealth that this world can produce are in debt to those who merely lend out the money that represents that wealth? So the proverb is true. The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is slave to the lender. You'll find that in Proverbs 22 and verse 7. And it is an apt description of the monetary system in the world in which you and I live. More astounding than the simple fact that banks don't lend money, they create money from debt, is the truth that debt and the accompanying money supply is virtually unlimited. And as we're seeing today, the opposite situation is also true. When there is no debt, there is no money. Mariner S. Eccles, chairman and governor of the Federal Reserve Board, put it this way. That is what our money system is. If there were no debts in our money system, there wouldn't be any money. That's probably news to you. It is to most people. Most people imagine that if all debts were paid, the state of the economy would improve. And that's certainly true on an individual level. It's certainly true for me in my personal financial situation. I'm sure it would be true for you because you're employed like I am. You work for a living. You draw a paycheck. And to the extent that you are debt-free, you have more cash, more to do with than you do if you're paying principal and interest to a bank. And because that's true for us, we believe that if everyone were out of debt, there would be more money to spend in general. But in our system, the truth is exactly the opposite. There would be no money at all. There it is. We are completely dependent on, you might say addicted to, credit, bank credit, because we are dependent on money for our economic existence, to produce the wealth, the goods and the services that we depend on to live and to enjoy life. But as the proverb says, the borrower is slave to the lender. In the Great Depression of the 20th century, the money supply shrank drastically, 27%. It did because of the availability of bank credit dried up. A similar phenomenon is occurring today. We all know this if we are watching the evening news. We're not confused. Why is the Federal Reserve making such an issue of having an open door, even to the point of doing something completely unprecedented, which is issuing announcements to major news media sources about the fact that they're open for business. They want to lend. And they want individual banks, regional banks, central banks, that are tied to the Federal Reserve System to borrow money. Because if they don't, this nation, and because this nation is the most powerful economic force in the world, every other nation in the world, will find itself in the midst of one of the most catastrophic economic depressions that the world has ever witnessed. When the central bankers came together in November of 2007, December of 2007, to avert a crisis, they clearly saw it as a mortal wound to the monetary system of the world, the system that keeps it all going. Roger H. Hemphill, credit manager for the Federal Reserve Bank in Atlanta, Georgia, had this to say about that. This is a staggering thought. We are completely dependent on the commercial banks. Someone has to borrow every dollar we have in circulation, cash or credit. If the banks create ample synthetic money, we are prosperous. If not, we starve. We are absolutely without a permanent money system. That's a frightening thought. When one gets a complete grasp of the picture, Mr. Hemphill says, the tragic absurdity of our hopeless position, is almost incredible. But there it is. And I'm here to tell you that that, by the way, is the good news. The bad news is this. Banks create only the principal amount of the debt. Wait a minute, you say. I have to pay back the principal amount of the debt plus interest. Yes, you do. Yes, I do. But banks don't create the money to pay the interest. So where does that money come from? Well, the only place borrowers can go to generate that money to pay the interest is the general economy's overall money supply. The problem is, as Mr. Hemphill has just pointed out to us, that money supply is limited to the amount of money that's been created through debt. The interest was not included when that money was created as debt. So everywhere, there are borrowers trying to obtain money to pay back principal and interest from a money supply that contains only principal. You see where this is going? See the problem here? It's clearly impossible for everyone to pay back the principal and interest because the interest money does not exist. You've been set up to fail. We have to function in a system that factors in a certain percentage rate of failure. Who designed this? We'll get to that. The magnitude of this problem can best be assessed by looking at long-term loans, your mortgage on your home, government debt. In those cases, the total amount of interest, if you add it all up, will be paid if the loan is paid in full, and it far exceeds the amount of the original debt. The interest on a home mortgage, a 30-year home mortgage, is usually somewhere in the neighborhood of 4 to 5 times the amount of the original debt, depending, of course, on the amount you borrowed. Unless a lot of extra money is created to cover the interest owed, in a non-functioning economy, in a poorly functioning economy, what will happen is a high rate of foreclosure on debt. That is exactly what you see happening today. And it's not just happening here in the United States. It's happening all over the world, everywhere. This monetary system has been mortally wounded. When people stop earning money, when jobs dry up and go away, loans get foreclosed, people fail, and it's devastating. It's emotionally traumatizing. It's distressing. It's embarrassing. And in many cases, it's just not their fault. But in some cases, if we're not careful how we manage debt, it can become our fault. So we have to be wise as a serpent as we proceed through this path. Everywhere there are borrowers trying to obtain money to pay back principal and interest from a money supply that contains only principal. To maintain a functioning society, economically speaking, the rate of foreclosure needs to remain low. To create that effect, more and more new debt money has to be created. That's why the Federal Reserve, that's why banks, central bankers all over the world are eager to infuse new money into the system to keep it from collapsing. But that new money is like old money. It's debt money. New debt money has to be created to satisfy the demands for money to service yesterday's debt. It's like trying to change a tire on a car that's still moving. Not a simple task, always. The result, of course, is to make the total amount of debt larger and larger. The consequences of increased debt is an increase in the amount of interest that must be paid. Not surprisingly. The ultimate result of this is a perpetually escalating and an inescapable spiral of mounting indebtedness. It is only the time lag between money's creation as new loans and its repayment that keeps the overall system from crashing down like a house of cards. Andrew Goss, a monetary historian, has compared our fractional reserve banking system, not just ours in the United States, but the fractional reserve banking system, to the child's game of musical chairs. So long as the music is playing, he tells us, there are no losers. There's one other difference. In the game of musical chairs, there's usually only one person who gets left out, for whom there is no chair when the music stops. In this system, it's thousands. It's become millions. However, as the credit beast grows larger and larger, so does its appetite. Now, not just a need, not just a desire, not just a means to achieve economic expansion, an actual addiction. The beast is addicted to the need for new money to sustain the life which has become a force on its own without direction and control. Why are interest rates so low? Why did your newborn baby receive a credit card solicitation in the mail? Why are governments everywhere spending at an ever-increasing rate? Could it be, as was noted in the article that appeared in the Times, to stave off the collapse of the entire monetary system? Any rational person at this point in this sermon would ask, okay, and you're all rational, so I know you're already asking the question that I'm going to pose, can this really go on forever? Isn't a collapse inevitable? Aren't we just talking about when, not whether? The answer lies partly in understanding the function of money. Money facilitates production and trade. As the money supply increases, the money will become increasingly worthless unless the volume of production and trade in the real world grows by the same amount. There has to be some rough equivalent between what is actually produced out of the earth or services actually rendered that are of value and the money that's used in exchange for those things. When there isn't an equivalence or a rough equivalence, when production ceases, when goods are not available, but there's still plenty of money, then the money becomes worthless. That, in a nutshell, summarizes the problem in Zimbabwe. Mr. Mugabe, having completely undone what was once a major agricultural force in the world, having virtually destroyed every other industry related to that particular nation's economy, he now finds himself in the unenviable position of sitting on a bunch of worthless money with nothing else to do. And the people starve, and the land has been turned to desert. Who made this system? Why is this a good idea? Production and supply, ground to a halt, nothing to spend money on. There is nothing for which new debt can or should be created in this economic terms, in these economic terms. Now, when you hear someone on the CNN or Bloomberg or, God forbid, even ABC, tell you that the economy is growing at 3% a year, you might assume that that rate of growth is expressed in constant terms, but it's not. That 3% that you hear about is over and above the growth from the previous year. This means that economic growth, when there is economic growth, is expressed not in arithmetic terms, but exponential terms. I'm not going to try to bore you with the distinctions at this point, except to say that arithmetic growth is virtually a straight line. Exponential growth rises like that. You might think of it in these terms. If you take a penny and you put it in your bank account, and then you double the amount every day. So day one, you put in 1 cent. Day two, you put in two. Day three, four cents. Day four, 8 cents. By the time you get to 30 days, you can't fund that. Well, you can't fund that even before you get to 30 days, because at 30 days, we're talking about somewhere over $5 million. That's exponential growth. Exponential growth is something most of us do not comprehend. Indeed, when the numbers get really big, no one can comprehend it. Our minds are finite, and exponential growth eventually leads to something more than what is finite. According to physicist Albert A. Bartlett, one of the greatest shortcomings of the human race is our inability to conceptualize exponential growth. Mr. Bartlett feels this way because he is familiar with just how many forces that act upon our lives that are affected by exponential growth. Most of them, he notes, are not good. But you don't have to be a physicist, and you don't have to know the difference necessarily between arithmetic and exponential growth to appreciate the simple truth that perpetual growth in a real economy requires perpetually escalating use of real-world energy and resources. That's a simple fact. You can't grow what you don't have. And to continue to create perpetual growth, you have to have more and more and more. And exponential growth requires even more than that. So more and more resources, as debt increases, as the money supply increases, as the demand for the money supply increases, more and more resources have to be stripped from the earth and turned to garbage to keep the system from collapsing. We have to rape our earth to feed the economic monetary beast. The economist Kenneth Boulding put it this way: anyone who believes exponential growth can go on forever in a finite world is either a madman or an economist. The prophet Isaiah wasn't really that clever. He simply said it this way. in chapter 24 of Isaiah, verses 1 through 13. Behold, the Lord will empty the earth and make it desolate, and he will twist its surface and scatter its inhabitants. And it shall be as with the people, so with the priest, as with the slave, so with the master, as with the maid, so with her mistress, as with the buyer, so with the seller, as with the lender, so with the borrower, as with the creditor, so with the debtor. The earth shall be utterly empty and utterly plundered. And the monetary system that we function under in this world today is designed to ensure that result. And it's working. Not that that's a good thing. The earth mourns and withers. The world languishes and withers. The highest people of the earth languish. The earth lies defiled under its inhabitants, for they have transgressed the laws, violated the statutes, broken the everlasting covenant. Therefore, a curse devours the earth, and its inhabitants suffer for their guilt. Therefore, the inhabitants of the earth are scorched, and few men are left. The wine mourns, the vine languishes, all the merry-hearted sigh. The mirth and the tambourines are stilled. The noise of the jubilant has ceased. The mirth of the lyre is stilled. No more do they drink wine with singing. Strong drink is bitter to those who drink it. The wasted city is broken down. Every house is shut up so that none can enter. How about your neighborhood? Looking pretty good today? Not as good as 2 years ago, I bet. There is an outcry in the streets for the lack of wine. All joy has grown dark. The gladness of the earth is banished. Desolation is left in the city. The gates are battered into ruins. For thus it shall be in the midst of the earth among the nations, as when an olive tree is beaten, as at the gleaning, when the grape harvest is done. There's a limit. There's a limit to what this earth can provide. There's a limit to what we can take. There's a limit to what we should take. Just as with ancient Israel, heaven and earth are witnessing against us. That has not quit. And at the end, when Jesus Christ intervenes, before we destroy ourselves and every bit of life on this planet, that fact will have to become abundantly clear. Did this happen by accident? Is it a conspiracy? Obviously, something huge is at stake here. When even an economist trained in this world sees the potential for a complete rape of the resources of this planet because of a monetary system that has an appetite that can never be satisfied, when even someone like that, who doesn't know necessarily, I don't think he knows the scriptures, can see that potentiality, what would we say? What's really going on? Well, the answer is that it did not happen by accident. And yes, it is a conspiracy. And something huge is at stake. David Rockefeller, in an address before the Trilateral Commission in 1991, and yes, the Trilateral Commission is a real body. It's a policy-making body. Conspiracy theorists love to beat these people up. But if you were to Google it and take a look at their website, look at their goals, their values, their plans, there's much there that you would agree with. I don't say there's anything that you would agree with in terms of their approach to achieving it. This is the system they created, as David Rockefeller is going to tell us. So I don't say that there's anything that you would agree with in terms of their approach to bringing the world together. to trying, in an effort to create peace, eliminate war, generate economic prosperity. In 1991, David Rockefeller gave an address before this commission in which he said, "We are grateful to the Washington Post, the New York Times, Time Magazine, and other great publications whose directors have attended our meetings and respected the promises of discretion for almost 40 years. It would have been impossible for us to develop our plans for the world if we had been subject to the bright lights of publicity during those years. But the world is now more sophisticated," Mr. Rockefeller goes on, "and prepared to march towards a world government." You don't have a problem with a one world government, do you? As I understand it, we're waiting for Jesus Christ to return to set that up. "The supranational sovereignty of an intellectual elite," Mr. Rockefeller continues, "and world bankers is surely preferable to the national autodetermination practiced in past centuries," and he means by nations, "in a political realm." So it is a conspiracy of nations. The nations of North America, Western Europe, and Japan in 1991, and many others since 1991, have joined that effort because they imagine that they can create a global government and a world economy capable of perpetual, exponential growth, which will establish justice with endless peace, prosperity, and freedom of choice for all of humanity. The mechanism that they have chosen to accomplish those laudable goals is a system that attempts to create prosperity, peace, and growth from debt. A system that is constantly, perpetually, and exponentially leveraging the future to pay for the present. A system that enslaves but does not liberate. That, as Isaiah points out, abuses and destroys the earth. That makes the wealth that they greedily covet possible. Sir Josiah Stamp, the director of the Bank of England, from 1928 to 1941, reputed to be the second richest man in England at the time, described the system this way. "The modern banking system manufactures money out of nothing. The process is perhaps the most astounding piece of sleight of hand ever invented. Banking was conceived in iniquity and born in sin. Bankers own the earth." God says he does, but "take it away from them, but leave them the power to create money, and with the flick of a pen, they will create enough money to buy it back again. Take this great power away from them, and great fortunes like mine will disappear. And they ought to disappear, for then this would be a better and a happier world to live in. But if you want to continue to be slaves of the banks and pay the cost of your own slavery, then let the bankers continue to create money and control credit. Surely something so huge is more than just a conspiracy of nations." And so it is. These nations have a leader. In 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 4, Paul identifies him as the God of this world. Later in 2 Corinthians 11, 14, Paul warns us that this particular God has the capacity to masquerade as an angel of light. These people, well, it's hard for me to say what they believe, but they bought this system. They own this system. They built this system. They believe in it. And they've managed to do a good job of keeping the details of its functioning away from popular understanding. Because when people prosper, people cease to think. They don't think about how the comforts that they enjoy are created. They abandon care when they should adopt concern. What the intellectual elite, the world bankers, and the sophisticated of the earth perceive as light in terms of the monetary system that they've created to create their wealth and take their pleasure is not light. They are pawns in a millennia-old game for dominion of the world, for control of the earth, an earth owned, as it is pointed out in Psalms, by God. The earth is mine. Satan's latest attempt to prove that he can create in his own way what can only be created by doing things the Father's way, that is, this sublime empire of growth, peace, justice, is nothing more than an imitation, his attempt to imitate the kingdom of God on earth. And these men and women and whoever else they are merely pawns in that game. Ezekiel describes Satan's prior attempts at creating such a world ruling empire as violent. He speaks of the abundance of his trade. I would say 90-1 or better as a return in a trade is abundant. It's also violent. Somebody got squeezed out. Somebody got hurt. So as we see the same ethic applied in the world in which we live, as was applied at the time that Satan mounted a rebellion against the Creator of all that was created, we can be sure that then as now, whatever system, whatever reference Ezekiel has to Satan's trade, his violence, it must have been a system that, just as the system today enslaves in perpetuity and destroys in order to create prosperity and wealth. It's incomprehensible that values which produce such results could ever create the kind of world the nations now contemplate. Surely such imaginings are, as King David wrote in Psalm 2, imagined in vain. Surely, when you hear about a world-ruling government capable of perpetual exponential growth, where there is peace, prosperity, and liberation, your mind contemplates the words of Isaiah in chapter 9, verses 6 and 7, where we read of the Messiah to whom all authority to rule the entire world is given. There, Isaiah tells us that the Messiah's authority will grow continually and that there will be endless peace. Justice will be established from the time that the Messiah establishes his presence on the earth forevermore. The result of endless peace and justice is, of course, true liberation and endless prosperity. When that Messiah returns, a time pictured by the upcoming Day of Trumpets, he will unmask the God of this world and expose him to the nations which now serve him in ignorance and blindness, blinded by his light, or what they think is light. Isaiah testifies of that time pictured by the upcoming Day of Atonement in Isaiah 14, verses 12 through 20. How you are fallen from heaven, O day star, son of dawn. How you are cut down to the ground, you who laid the nations low. Jesus Christ, according to Revelation 18 and according to Matthew 24, has to return. Because it's not just war, and it's not just disease, and it's not just environmental tragedy. It's this whole system upon which people rely blindly for their sustenance that has to come down before it destroys this earth. How you are cut down to the ground, you who laid the nations low. You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven above the stars of God. I will set my throne on high. I will sit on the mount of the assembly in the far reaches of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. But you are brought down to Sheol, to the far reaches of the pit. Those who see you will stare at you and ponder over you. Is this the man who made the earth tremble? Who shook kingdoms, who made the world like a desert and overthrew it, cities, who did not let his prisoners go home. There is no way to repay this debt. There is no liberation in this system. No prisoners are going free. Not from this system. We will work until we die. I speak as a human being with respect to the system that rules this world. People work until they die, and they never achieve liberation. They never achieve what ancient Israel had, land from which they could produce food. Water, which was free, air, which was free. Everything they needed to sustain themselves, provided by their Creator for free. No debt attached. And they could sustain themselves if they worked. We are slaves. We work for a wage. And there is nothing in this system that's going to make that change. There's nothing in this system that's going to allow that to change. And the people that control it, the forces that shape it, and the God of this world don't want it to change. The only thing that's going to change it is the return of the Messiah. Those who see you will stare at you and ponder over you. Is this the man who made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms, who made the world like a desert and overthrew its cities, who did not let his prisoners go home? All the kings of the nations lie in glory, each in his own tomb, but you are cast out away from your grave like a loathed branch of the pit, like a dead body trampled underfoot. You will not be joined with them in burial because you have destroyed your land. You have slain your people. When the kingdom of God is established on this earth in the millennium, this system now in place to create wealth and prosperity will not be reformed. It will be obliterated and replaced. That does not mean the elimination of debt or the use of credit. God provided for both in ancient Israel, and there's a proper way to do that. It does mean that a different system of values will animate economic life. That's a topic for another time. What's important for us as we approach these fall holy days is to, and with everything that's happened in the world over the last year or so, particularly in the economic realm, it's important for us to appreciate that the power of the system that rules this world, that determines our economic outcome, is deeply ingrained. It's part of us in ways that we may not even appreciate or recognize. And so is the silence on the subject, by the way. No one's going to tell you this about this system. These things are not taught in school. I didn't learn them in law school, and you'd think you would. and they don't ever garner media attention, at least to the extent that they do, that they should. Revelation 18 is in part an indictment against this system, and it is in part a judgment against this system, actual judgment. And in verse 4 of that chapter, you and I are commanded to come out of her and not partake of her sins. Now that we know a little more about her and her sins, perhaps we have a better basis upon which to evaluate the ways that we are in her, or that she is in us. In any event, there does come a time when some of God's people are tested on this point, a time when those who have rejected the system will be excluded from it, will be deprived of the opportunity to buy or to sell, a test of faith, a test of resolve. As we approach this fall Holy Day season, at a time when the economies of the nations have been mortally wounded and are in search of healing by the means with which they were mortally wounded, which is an odd sort of twist of logic, at least to me, at a time when bigotry and aggression throughout the world are experiencing a resurgence, when resources are challenged and people are grasping for their share, let us focus ever more sharply on the real solution, the coming of the Messiah, Jesus Christ, the binding of the adversary, Satan, and the establishment of the one world ruling government that is truly capable of bringing justice, liberation, and perpetual growth to all humanity.